Commander Repard, Real 10. We're talking about the process for launching the Walrus from HMS Sheffield, and you were going through the actual technical process.
I'd reached the point of describing how there was a delay, the pressure of the cordite built up and actually started to work a catapult, which multiplied the movement by having pulleys around wires. The delay was a matter of a very few seconds, but it did mean that if the ship was rolling, the engineer officer, who held a little flag up, which could be seen both by the chap pulling the trigger and by the pilot of the aircraft, because he would be revving his engine up too, would sometimes drop his flag at the moment that the Walrus had to, the gun had to be fired, when the Walrus was pointing straight to the sea, because we'd rolled down in that direction. And it was frightening enough to watch. But subsequently, I flew in the Walrus and sat in the thing when it was happening, and I found it absolutely devastatingly frightening to see that the thing was going to be fired when one was pointing towards the sea. Because as you roll back again, the other extreme was that you'd be pointing so much up into the air that you wouldn't be going fast enough and you'd stall. So there's a very nice judgment involved. We didn't lose one that way, but every time it looked very, very frightening. The Walrus, in the case I was talking about, where the postman sent off, he was the regulating petty officer, they took off and they decided to go and make a low pass over Renan, where the Admiral was, on the way to Gibraltar, which was about 30 miles away, I suppose. And they got mixed up with the funnel spec of Renan and stalled and hit her, and they were all killed, which was very sad. They popped in a regulating petty officer, quite apart from the officers of the crew on board. I think it was a crew of three. I'd like to amplify a little bit about the Walrus, because it's been obsolete for so long. It's almost difficult to believe that these things were so robust and how they mixed sea-going qualities with air-going qualities. The process I've described of getting them off, of course, naturally had to be followed by the process of how on earth you got them on board again. The process was simple in theory. You got the Walrus into the sea and it used its propeller to push it through the water at the speed the ship could go along, and the ship held a crane over the side with a hook on the bottom of it, and there was a wire strop on the top wing with a ring in the middle of it, and one of the crew climbed out for it and climbed up onto the top wing and put the hook through the ring. But visualize a sea which is ocean sea, because you fire these things off for reconnaissance, or as we had once for looking on the other side of a U-boat's ply ship. And you've got heavy swells, sometimes with sea on top of the swell. Well, the swell can be coped with, especially in the open ocean, because the tops of the swells can be as far as 1/4 mile apart. But the sea can't be dealt with that way. So the drill was that the ship had to make a slick on the water, which meant a calm bit where there wasn't any sea. The way you do that is to go fairly fast and put the wheel hard over and skid the ship sideways. And it leaves, during the process of the sort of boiling water, it takes the tops off the waves. But the timing has to be such that is the moment that the Walrus comes in to land on these smooth waves, but going up and down over the swell. And it literally flies up and down over the swell, finding the problem at the bottom of the swell where there's no wind and the top of the swell where there is a heck of a lot of wind. And it's trying to land into the wind so that the rate at which it hits the water is at its minimum. That is only the beginning of the problem. The Walrus has at last got down on the water without hitting the top of a wave or turning over or anything awful like that. It's then got to proceed at the same speed of the ship, maybe about 8 or 10 knots, where the ship retains steerage way, and the Walrus somehow has to judge how far away the inboard wingtip is, close to the armor plate on the side of the cruiser. And if everything is perfect, assuming it's dead calm and you're in Scapa Flow or something, then when the crane is extended as far as it can be and the great big hook is hanging down vertically, the wingtip is only about 4 feet away from the side of the ship at the time you hook on. Add to that all the movement of the ship, the rolling of the ship, the swinging of the hook, and the movement of the aircraft itself in the water, and the accuracy required to do it. Every now and then the wingtip hits the ship, and it crumples the edge of the wing. Well, as these things were designed for naval use, of course the shipwright was the chap who came and put a new bit of wingtip on, and they kept them in the hangar as spares because these things were going to happen. And they were so robustly built that they could put up with having a wingtip broken that way without breaking the whole wing off. Another interesting feature is that as soon as the thing got onto the water, one of the crew moved forward, where right up in the forward end of the hull, the top of the hull, there was a circular hole which was actually designed for a gunner, and it had a single Lewis gun in it. But on the water, of course, it would let the water come in because it would be dipping into the sea. You didn't want water in the hull too much. And so you hoped that the aircrewman who worked forward, the gunner, was fairly fat so that he could fill the hole up and like a cork in a bottle and stop the water getting into the aircraft. Meanwhile, the poor devil who had to climb out of the cockpit and climb up the forward side of the wing, that's to say on the front end of the engine, but the opposite end of the propeller, which was abaft it, also had to hook himself on so that if he lost his footing, he didn't fall into the propeller and get diced like a carrot. And occasionally they did lose their footing. The next horror he had to face was that this large hook, which was stabilized by a weight just above it, had to be caught and stopped in its momentum. Then you had to, as the aircraft was going up and down quite sharply underneath, the moment when the hook had to be put through the ring had to be very nicely judged, and your fingers had to be in the right place, because if everything went tight suddenly, you lost your fingers. So by the time the aircraft came back, there were signs of relief all round, as you would imagine. I only did one trip in the ocean in the Walrus, and I found it absolutely terrifying. I was jolly glad that my job was just to sit tight and do nothing on the way back. We didn't actually hit the wing on the side that time. But I did admire the way these, we had two of these things, and in the course of the commission, we lost two aircraft altogether. One crashed, one disappeared somewhere, and I can't remember what happened to it. But I was aware, more vividly perhaps, why when I first joined Sheffield, my green pajamas had been thrown over the side by someone in the ship's company because they were superstitious about the color green.
What was that?
I don't know why. It was built in, and I've remained superstitious about the color green for the rest of my life.
You don't know what the origin is?
No, I don't.
You just follow it?
I just follow it. They felt it strongly enough. You know, it was made known to me that it wasn't done with anything personal about me. It's just that they didn't want to have green pajamas, thank you, on the ship.
And did everybody follow that?
I don't remember seeing anybody wearing anything vividly green, no. In any ship I was in. But I didn't ask anymore. I just took it for granted. Sheffield still. There were two other events I hadn't mentioned in Sheffield. One was when Force H was in the Atlantic looking for something, and I can't remember what. So Ark Royal had flown off a number of swordfish to look for it. And while the aircraft were airborne, a sea fog came up which covered the ships up about halfway up the masts and above the level of the flight deck of the carrier, so they could not see to land on the carrier. We could see the aircraft from the crow's nest, and eventually it was decided that they would have to go into the sea because they were running out of fuel. There was no question of getting to land anywhere, they were too far out. And they were told to drop a depth charge just before when they were, before they ditched, so that they wouldn't have the depth charges with them, and we could hear the bang, and hopefully that would give us an idea where they were, and we could look for them. But in fact, visibility was so bad, we found none of them at all. And it made the point of the sort of risks which the carrier chaps had to face every time they took off. Another event in Sheffield was the bombardment of Genoa. Force H, in order to frighten the Italians, I think, as much as anything else, rather than particular damage, although there were particular targets, set off for Genoa, supported by a battleship or two. I think it was Barham. I don't now remember which battleship it was, but we certainly had Barham and Renan there in Sheffield. And we had put up an extra funnel made of by the chippies and the sailmaker so that we wouldn't easily be recognized. But in fact, we saw on the whole way towards Genoa from Gibraltar, we saw not a single shadowing aircraft. It would seem the Italians hadn't thought anybody would dare to do that. So on the 9th of February, 1941, at dawn, we were off Genoa. The aircraft from Ark Royal were flown off to attack La Spezia, which was a naval base. And we took on certain targets ashore in the Genoa area. And when we opened fire in the mists of dawn, an absolutely calm Mediterranean day, the Italians quite clearly thought it was an air raid because they were firing masses of anti-aircraft things up in the air. And I couldn't see La Spezia, it was too far away from there. But there was absolutely no retaliation. We had no attacks on us on the way back. But there was a curious follow-up many years later when I visited Genoa on a formal visit in another ship altogether, Battle Axe, in the 1950s, early 50s. I went to see the cathedral in Genoa, which I'd never seen, and I was having a run ashore. And I was very surprised to find an English 15-inch shell upright in the entrance to the cathedral with a slot cut in it, and one was invited to put arms in there. And apparently this had hit the cathedral but hadn't exploded. So I put arms in there and did not admit that I'd been party to sending it there in the first place.
Now, the next thing I want to deal with is going back into the chronological sequence when you were aboard HMS Tartar, and after the convoy, you returned with PQ-18, or the reversed thing.
QP-14.
That's it. And the next thing was in September 1942, I think, is when you were involved in the landings in North Africa.
I think the timing there is probably a bit wrong. September...
It sounds wrong to me as well. I'm working off the letter, but I think it's possibly a little wrong.
Yes, I'm not sure. The September 42 could... Yes, it probably is the landings in North Africa. Because at that point, there was great anxiety that the French might object in some way, and there had been secret negotiations we'd heard about, no details, of course, but we were aware that there was a large French force at Toulon, and that they were all seething with rage because we'd had to destroy a number of French ships in Mazovia. So there was a very large fleet protecting the landing areas out of sight of the coast, the north of the coast.
Now, you'd gone out with a convoy with the troops, hadn't you?
Yes.
Can you tell us about that first, I think?
We were hurrying back to the Med again, and we went about 20 west, I think, fairly far away from the submarine areas, we hoped, and with reasonably fast troop ships in this case. And we were, they made about 12 or 14 knots, which was much more than the ordinary convoys of food and so on.
Was the convoy attacked at all?
No, the convoy was not attacked. The one that I was with, anyway, wasn't attacked on the way south. But some of the other convoys subsequently were attacked to such an extent that there's another story to follow. But before that happened, I was part of the covering force in Tata, not involved in the actual landings themselves at all. And in very bad weather indeed, in the Mediterranean, which blows up very suddenly, and a huge screen of 22 destroyers around the capital ships and cruisers, aircraft carriers, come the dawn, we were still in station on the ship on our starboard side, near the peak of the screen, but there were no capital ships in sight and no sign of the starboard side of the screen at all either. Somebody had missed a signal somewhere, and so we had about 10 or 12 destroyers all nominally in a screen, but no capital ships in sight to be screened, which caused considerable upset, as you would imagine. But it can happen. No radar, no wireless transmissions, tiny little light signals being made, and filthy weather. It brought home that the sea is can bring its own problems, quite apart from the enemy. We were using Mazar Kabir as a base ourselves by the time the troops had got ashore and settled in. It must have been a matter of weeks, I suppose, no more than that. But by then, we needed fresh stores, fresh supplies, and we hadn't had any. It was also apparent that our teeth were becoming loose and our gums were beginning to bleed a bit. In fact, it was the classic scurvy sort of incident. We'd got down to the point where we had no fresh greens, no fruit or anything like that, and we had broached the lime juice barrels, which were in fact stored in the rum store. But in Mazar Kabir, I found we were alongside, just down the jetty, from an American support ship. So I went to call on the executive officer of the support ship, and knowing that the American Navy is dry, I wondered what they were carrying. Discovered that they had eggs and chickens and all sorts of things we hadn't seen for a long time. So I wondered if they would be interested in having a case of whiskey. And I found that they would be very interested in a case of whiskey, and I had to get extra transport and a working party along because I got a dozen eggs and a chicken for every sailor on board Tata in return for the case of whiskey. And eventually, the supply caught up, but I think some of our supplies probably been sunk on the way out there. This is what we thought at the time. But I was interested how quickly the scurvy disappeared when we did actually get some proper fruit and vegetables. At that time, Tata started to work from Algiers as a rear base as the army had progressed up towards Bonn. And we were beginning to probe into the Narrows. It was quite clearly the two armies from the east and the west were converging on the Germans in the middle. The role of the Navy was to interdict the movement of supplies as far as possible across the Narrows from men and Europe into North Africa in support of Rommel, or indeed support of the forces who were withdrawing in front of the Americans and British troops who were working up from the western end of the Med. Some of the Americans were very new to the idea of this sort of war at that point. They were, they thought, I felt, and from the noises they made, that they'd been a bit influenced by the Hollywood aspect of war. And there were some appalling stories that came out of, as one did with every sort of new troops or new sailors, new ships in battle for the first time, who were discovering the hard way, things which perhaps you can never teach when it's not for real. But from Tata's point of view, it was our interdictions based on bone which became the most exciting thing.
So you moved, that's further along the coast.
We were moving up behind the army, in fact, up as far as the army could capture a port. We went into it with a tanker. But there was nothing much between Algiers and Bern. Bern's lovely anchorage, some rather nice colonial sort of houses in the way, and the lovely gardens and so on. And that was the place we came back to, and where there was a tanker. But it tended to be bombed most days, or most nights. Days usually, because we were then back in harbour and resting, whereas we'd spent the night going down in towards the Narrows. These trips could be very exciting because it was a routine trip and therefore predictable to the enemy of what we'd be doing. And we found that there were both submarines and e-boats in the Narrows, and that the aircraft, knowing when we'd be going back towards Bern in the half light in the morning, would be waiting for us to the westward so that we were silhouetted against the rising sun and the light opening up on the eastern horizon. So we were pretty trigger happy in going up maybe a couple of destroyers at a time. On one particular occasion, we had e-boats probably come down from Sicily or somewhere to the west of Sicily. And we also carried on board Dutchmen who were linguists and could speak German and who were listening in to the frequencies that the enemy might be using. And we realized that there were e-boats at sea from the talk from between the e-boats. And then we detected something moving on the radar distance, which was probably the e-boats. And we decided we'd have a go at them. It struck me that star shell to light it up and then firing the 4.7s with contact fuses might just work. But it would probably be more effective if we tried out something new, and which the captain said I could try out. And the e-boats were very quick. They went up to 40 knots plus. And I decided that we would treat them from a calculating point of view of gunnery as aeroplanes, and that we would use fused shells which would burst in the air. As they were thin-skinned things. With any luck, we'd get shrapnel into them. We had tried the other thing with star shells and the others, but it hadn't worked. The comments from the e-boat commanding officers reported back to me on my headphones had told me it wasn't working. We'd tried the other thing. But when I tried the treating them as aeroplanes, it not only worked, but I had an excited Dutchman coming on the phone saying, "You've killed him, you've killed him." And he patched through to me the noises being made by the German commanding officer of that e-boat group as he was dying on the radio, which was a new experience for me altogether. But it did reflect the enthusiasm of the Dutchmen, who did not like Germans one little bit, because many of them came from Rotterdam, which had been stukered into the ground, flattened. So that when a little while later, when we had become rather more effective at clearing the Germans out of North Africa, and Rommel had given the order that they were to escape and do a Dunkirk, we received a signal from Admiral Cunningham, who was Commander-in-Chief Mediterranean, under whom all these operations were coordinated, that we were to sink, burn, and destroy, and let none escape. We were also aware, from what had been happening before, that we were likely to be, if we stopped to pick up people in small boats, we may well be torpedoed. So we were not to stop. This left a bit of a dilemma. How do you stop people getting by in small boats if you can't stop? Well, there are only two ways to do it. One's to run them down and pick up anybody who might get in the water without stopping, or you murder them at long range with guns and things. And we decided that the thing to do was to sweep through these in comparatively calm weather with both the lower booms extended, with ropes and ladders and things down to the lower booms, and with sailors armed with heaving lines and grapnels and so on, to pick up anybody if we ran them down. And so we did run down several boatfuls of Germans escaping from North Africa, and we picked some up. Also, we did not pick some up because they couldn't find them, or they went astern, and we weren't going to stop for them in those circumstances, because we'd already had ships being hit when they did stop to pick up people. Having got German prisoners of war on board, of course, you've then got another problem. They've got to be looked after in sentries and so on. They've got to be kept in one place and fed and given air and exercise and so on. And on a bright sunny day, five or six of these chaps were up on the pom-pom gun deck above the iron deck amidships, taking the air and generally looking around. And what apparently happened was that the Dutchmen were also up there, because they could speak German, couldn't they? And they said in German to them, "Oh, look over there," and pointed out in the direction sort of northwest somewhere. And blame it on, the pom-pom went off behind them. And there were bits of German all over the ship. Now, what actually happened, I don't know, but pom-poms don't go off by accident. And I suspect that this too, rather as some other horrid incident I'd seen where Polish ships had surfaced a submarine, and although I saw survivors coming up the starboard side, there were a lot of dead Germans over the port side. I suspect that there was something pretty horrid going on. So we took precautions to prevent that happening again, of course. And there were some Germans whom we returned to the army and to look after when we went back to harbour. Based on Bern, I'd made friends with the local Air Force people, and there were some American Marauders, which are twin-engine light bombers, reconnaissance planes, based there. And I persuaded the Americans to give me a flight. And I think it was engine testing or something like that. But we took off from the airfield, about 8 miles inland from Bern Harbor. And we went along the coast at about 4,000 feet, going west. When the I was in the second pilot seat, as they didn't need a full crew to do the flight. And the captain of the aircraft quite suddenly said, "Submarine," and started to dive. And so the chaps in the back got all ready to drop bombs on them. And I recognized that it was not a submarine, it was a landing craft. Made a nice wake and all the rest of it. He thought it was the conning tower of the submarine. I knew from my knowledge of ships and things that it wasn't. So I hauled back on the joystick, as we had dual control. And he gung-ho fought it. And so we had the plane going along like a porpoise for a while, with me pulling back and him pushing forward. Boy, he said, "Geez, you're right. It's a landing craft." And I don't think the landing craft ever realized how lucky they were. On another occasion, I was flying there in a bow fighter as a supernumerary, because normally they only have two in the crew. And again, it was engine testing. And
that was a British squadron.
British bow fighter, yes. They're night fighters, really. And engine testing in broad daylight. Lovely day again. And when we got somewhere over the coast, the radio signals came in, RT came in, to say that they thought there was a raid coming in. So the aircraft captain told me that I should be prepared and put my parachute on, please, and if they got into a dogfight, would I please open the hatch and jump out, because they were rather handicapped by having a third person on board if they had to do some fighting. So he said in a friendly way he would tell everybody where I'd jumped, and so they could get somebody out to pick me up. I thought that was their bad news indeed. I was jolly glad when we weren't actually vectored in to intercept anybody coming in.